Okay, hello, welcome to the Tuesday Night Discussion Group. We'll be discussing Steve Ozenich's The Great Pain Deception. Faulty medical advice is making us worse. We'll be discussing tonight chapters 36 and 37. Chapter 36 is Trouble Healers, Unconscious Resistance to Change. And chapter 37 is it gone yet? You still here? So, these have been some great studies. We got plenty of callers here tonight. It's going to be a great discussion. And I'd like to give the disclaimer before we start. I do need to let everyone know that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. If you have a medical concern, you should see a properly licensed physician or a TMS physician. Now, with that being said, we're going to give the summary off to Bruce MC. Thank you, Bruce.
Okay, well, we're dealing with two chapters tonight. Chapter 36, Trouble Healers, Unconscious Resistance to Change. And chapter 37, Is It Gone Yet? Are you still here, huh? And that's got to do, the second chapter has to do with monitoring, overly monitoring. And the first one, Trouble Healers, enumerates all of the different strategies that people can employ to avoid healing, because we were just talking about how healing can occur just by soothing and allowing one of these fellows in here, Grodrick, would call the id to heal itself, that kind of detached pose that is so lacking in modern medicine today. Chapter 36 lists a lot of the unconscious reasons that people don't let go and let their natural healing capacity do its thing and get rid of their TMS pain. Now, in Trouble Healers, Steve addresses the problem of a frustrating group that he labels Trouble Healers. These are the small percentage of people who don't heal or heal more slowly because of such obvious reasons as early extreme emotional separation trauma resulting in intense anxiety that can't be overcome with merely with Dr. Sarno's knowledge therapy. That's the people who don't get it. And Steve seems to think that these trouble healers instead require intense counseling, Jungian shadow work, and perhaps one of the power therapies like programmed dreams. He says that deep down inside, some people need their pain, although they don't consciously want it. In other words, he's delineating this conflict between the unconscious and the conscious mind, which seems to play itself out in TMS. It's the driving force behind TMS. And he gives a lot of variations on what's come to be called secondary gain, although he doesn't use that term. He says the pain lets them opt out of situations they don't want to be in because they are unconsciously feeling trapped by outside observers, or they simply cannot say no. And they get attention for others when you're in pain. That's classic secondary gain, isn't it? Low self-esteem makes them think they deserve pain. And he has an example of Jessica, who dreams of her mother, and she stops running, one of her power dreams, I guess. And Jessica's unconscious motivation for change may not have outweighed the attention that her pain brought her at the time. In other words, she's getting more attention by staying that way. There are all these unconscious motivations for not healing. And then he has a section, Migraine Mama, where people recreate the victimization neurotransmitters that Bruce Lipton, PhD at Stanford, suggests occurs in these situations. Steve says that the back pain becomes part of who they are. They identify themselves as Carrie the Cripple, Migraine Mary, or he's always got his humor in here, Harry Hemorrhoid. he says it's plain and simple that people begin to see themselves as they feel that others see them, and so that perception, of malfunction eventually becomes them. Their pain becomes their identity. I have seen this myself, where there was a woman with fibromyalgia in PT. Luckily, I spent a couple of years in PT trying to get it right structurally. So I saw lots of cases. There was a woman who came in with a, one of those scooters. She had fibromyalgia so bad that she couldn't walk, and she came in to be massaged and talked to. She seemed to get a lot of attention out of this, and her dialogue, her monologues always indicated that she was engaged in attention-getting behavior with this infirmity she had. Steve talks about sticking points in healing, fear of change. We cling to old situations and relationships that have essentially ended. If the condition, pain, or disease is really bad, it may require complete permanent relationship change. That's one thing that he emphasizes in these really bad cases. It's telling you that you're not doing something right, but you might not be doing anything right. Your whole manner of life, like in the case of that woman who's in her on her walker and coming in for massage, and also getting money from the state with Social Security benefits. I think that, Sossel talks about that in the 2020 episode, where people are getting monetary benefits. I think Mark Sofer talks about that in his book, too, where you're getting your identity reinforced with cash payments, so you just stay there.
It's sort of like an unconscious secondary gain.
Yeah, unconscious second. All these variations seem like secondary gain to me.
Some of it is conscious. Some people are conscious of
pain in your condition, and you're getting more strokes from that. Maybe that's what's soothing them. That's the cash payments and the attention are the soothing that they need, that they're not getting in their lives. They haven't got any mama to stroke their brow, but they've got, you know, the welfare checks.
I'm sure when the money comes in, they get to spend it. That is a little soothing, you know.
And he talks too about purple hearts, Dr. Mises' concept of woodology, and it immediately occurred to me that this was like in that Elton John song, Leon wears his war wound like a crown. He calls his child Jesus. So it's where someone capitalizes on their circumstances by using the street value of the social currency of their wound, the manipulative value of their wound, to maintain their posture as a victim. Victimization comes into play here. Sossel calls it a gerosomatic illness too in the 2020 segment, where people capitalize on their illness due to the compensation provided by the social welfare system. Now, I don't know
They were maimed their whole life. They and this is another part in the same chapter that they just think that they're, you know, they're like this, and their legs hurt. So, like you said about the crutch or something, it's an extension of the man's arm. And then,
Steve talks in the last section about Jungian shadow work and sheltered needs. He says that Dr. Sarno and Jungian shadow work psychiatrists both believe it is necessary to look deep inside and find reasons not to try and alter behavior and symptoms, since symptoms and behaviors are only effects of what's going on in the shadow, in the unconscious. And I'm sure we can open the discussion there. I I went through all of the sections there.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is really he opens up a whole Pandora's box when people don't heal, and comes up with all of these different reasons that could be behind it. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of them, aren't there?
Yeah, well, you know, like the first one here with C.S. Lewis quote, you have to sneak past the watchful dragons of self-consciousness. And he says, if you are thinking about healing, then you are no longer healing. You are only thinking about healing. And that was something that I, you know, mentioned right before we started the program here. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit, because I know as long as I was thinking about healing, as long as I was trying to heal, the pain stayed, you know? It was like when it just became second nature, or, you know, I speak a lot about habit and second nature, and when I respond to people on the TMS Wiki, it's because when you're just doing this process, you know, like it's just habit, and you're not trying to do it, it's just, you're just doing it, then to me, that's when you start to get better, when you stop. That, to me, that's how you stop trying, is because you have learned how to do it so well that it's just second nature. You just do it, you know? Anybody want to say anything about that? Mention? Bring anything up about that? You know? I mean, learn to heal.
I'm kind of in an uproar because I was reading The Atlantic this morning, and there's someone doing an attack on Sam Harris and the neuroscientists, saying that they are denying free will. And what they're talking about, it seems to me, and we're talking about, is another kind of free will, to delve into the unconscious and actually change the biochemistry of your brain, like Bruce Lipton talks about. This is real change. It isn't just buying asparagus or carrots or broccoli in the fruit section of the supermarket. These are the kind of choices this guy is saying Sam Harris denies. But what the neuroscientists are talking about is real conscious choice about the condition of your mind. And that's what this stuff really takes, is a makeover of your mental space. Not buying asparagus versus broccoli or Coke versus Pepsi. This is kind of a false dichotomy that people confuse with free will.
You have to stop. You have to stop tying yourself to the pain so much. You have to, in a way, separate yourself from it. You know, like every time somebody asks you, how's your day? And if your answer every time is, well, you know, I've had this terrible knee pain all week. I mean, if that's your answer every time, well, you're still tied into that pain. And if you can get to the point where, even though the pain might be in the knee, if you can still get to the point where you say, hey, my day's great, even though that might be a lie, eventually that lie turned true. You know? I mean, that's one of the things that the neuroscience also knows, that when you start telling yourself enough, it'll come to pass. You know, I mean, hey, if I say that I'm healed, and I say it enough and believe it, then I'll get healed.
I have a quote from the chapter that I can relate to that. And this is such an important concept. I mean, he calls it nonlinearity about, and I see this on the forums all the time, people's pain will get worse. And they'll be really scared, but it takes them a little while to realize that, no, that's just part of the process. So this is what Steve writes about this. He says, be advised, pain may worsen during various healing stages for no obvious reason. As the emotion rises to the surface, and it will if you're healing, the pain must increase in order to prevent the expression or recognition of the unwanted. Pain tells us that we're on the verge of change, coming face to face with what we know to be true deep within, yet won't admit to. Faith is then necessary to move forward when the other side can't be seen and isn't fully known. So I just thought that was, I love that quote because, like I said, we see it all the time.
That's awesome, Forbes.
Yeah, where people write in and they say, oh, I've been doing this for 3 days and all of a sudden it's gotten worse.
Or it's actually good that it got worse. 2 weeks. Yeah, well, you know, it's just part of the process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Enjoy just wrote in the chat room. She said the pain must increase in the face of the unwanted. She said that's good. She likes that.
I was trying to quote it in the chat. I think that's what you just said, wasn't it?
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, but it was just the fact that you recognize its value too. I mean, it is kind of interesting.
Very interesting.
Things just change when you're starting to explore TMS. And usually they get better, but sometimes they'll temporarily get worse.
Yeah.
But that's where you're engaging.
Sorry, Bruce.
Oh, okay. You're engaging the shadow self then. You're going into the unconscious. You're bound to find some things in there that go bump in the night that scare you unconsciously. And you're going to get symptoms, aren't you?
And we can contrast that with the previous paragraph, which is another one of my favorite ones. He says, change occurs much more rapidly when relaxed and at ease and with confidence. So making healing fun is an important decision. It expedited my recovery. People heal faster when they, quote, let life's problems resolve themselves. Go do something you've always wanted to with excitement and ease up on you. And that reminded me of that wonderful thread I saw, Herbie, you had responded to it, where the guy was talking about how good it felt to go running. And I love that thread. Remind me of that thread. Yeah.
He was hurting. He was hurting. He's in pain, and his heart's beating, and he's sweating, or just thinking about running, he's sweating. But when he goes out and he actually starts doing running, all of a sudden the pain lets up. His body starts feeling normal, and he feels at peace. And it was pretty awesome because, you know, he looked fear right in the eye and he jumped right on it and did what his body and his mind didn't want him to do. And he did it anyway. And he got to feeling better. And it was, he said he found what he needed to do to get better, you know? And I thought that was pretty awesome. He found something that a great tool that was going to help him.
Well, what I took from it wasn't just overcoming fear. It was also the idea of he had found something which relaxed him, which made him feel good every day, that, you know, he could kind of, there's this concept that's been studied recently in psychology called flow, where you're just in the moment, you're in the zone, you know, what athletes might call in the zone. And he was in the zone. He was just enjoying his run and enjoying the natural, you know, pain relievers flowing through his brain, the endorphins, and just, he'd found his thing.
Yes, he did. I wonder if he's on here tonight. Brandon 101.
One thing I noticed about that woman who came into PT on the the scooter, who had to be helped onto the massage table and so on. If you asked her how she was doing, the first thing she did was give a long list of pain and suffering. And almost in an apologetic way, but that was her identity. Was obviously this whole host of symptoms. There was no her anymore. She had become her disease, and this was the way she got by. This was her calling card, her means of transacting with the world, was this whole host of symptoms.
Yeah, well, and so this is such an interesting chapter, all of these things. I mean, one thing which brings up is that Dr. Sarno is very clear that TMS is not about secondary gain. At the same time, as you noticed early on, or you noted early on in the call, a lot of the things that are talked about in this chapter sound a lot like secondary gain. And I was just wondering, I'd love to open it up to the listeners. I see a bunch of people who have muted themselves. I muted one phone caller. 4090 are now unmuted. But does anyone else want to share their thoughts on that? Like, how does secondary gain fit into TMS?
Well, Tennis Tom has something to say.
Can you hear me, gang?
Yeah, Tom.
Well, one comment about, okay, I forgot what that comment was, but I'm 65, so I've learned the right to be forgetful. At 65, all of a sudden, if you don't write things down. Yeah, and I do live in California where it's against the law to get old, and and aging is a disease. So what Forrest was talking about, what were you talking about, Forrest?
Secondary gain.
Yeah, well, I think I'm starting to go on another one of my rants, my political rants, but the government environment wants us to be sick. They want to control us now with this healthcare plan, and I don't mean to get political, but it has to be. And that's one way of controlling everyone is by controlling their health, or in our case, their diseases. And it all goes through the government now. So there's so many people I've known who are on SSI, which is like if you have a disability, you get a check for life, and there's very little regulation of it. I've seen people I know who are working under the table, several jobs. This guy did now, but he lived a ripe old age. And he was perfectly able to work, and he was one of the hardest working people I know, but he got a paycheck from the government for being mentally ill. And the funny thing was he worked as a receptionist for his psychiatrist's office. So he was well enough to do that. He was a hardworking guy. But so, yeah.
He joined the industry. He was part of the industry, of the pain industry. Paid to be part of it.
I don't think that was a secondary gain, though. That was just, you know, hey, here's some free money right here, and hey, why not take it, you know?
Yeah, so I think that's called the primary gain.
Yeah.
I think there's
primary
gain. I kind of wonder. Oh, you can go, Bruce.
They used to call that crazy money. A lot of people in Berkeley worked that. They were too crazy to work. And any job they would hold, they would act out and knock over the carts, or, you know, they were unable to hold a job. And this labeled them as, I know a guy's sister who did this, and now she lives at the end of a dirt road in Oregon getting checks. She's too crazy to work. And I guess you have to get yourself classified that way. Well, she is too crazy to work.
Yeah, and once you're classified that way, no one comes by to unclassify you. It's like there's no one checking. So there is such a thing as primary gain. I believe Dr. Sarno writes about it. And years ago when he wrote his first books, he said, well, it's not too many people. But now I think it's increasingly people are trying to figure out how do we get on the bandwagon. And those of us who work or have worked for a living, I think, are the ones who are not that bright. Why work when the government will send you a paycheck not to work, and then you can work under the table? So there's an increasing good reasons to get disabled and have diseases, you know?
Yeah, John Stossel calls this gerosomatic illness in the 2020 segment, where people capitalize on their illness due to the compensation provided by the social welfare system. Well, it's like a bottomless pit, isn't it? Or it's like a whirlpool. Once you get pulled into that, you're not going to come out.
Well, eventually it has a bottom. And it's when you reach the percentage, which we're very close to reaching, where the people who are working and they see those about them who aren't working and are gaining, and their taxes go up and up and up, and they finally throw in the towel and say, screw this. I'm not working my butt off so this guy can have a great life at my expense, and they quit working so hard or quit working entirely and sign up for the dole themselves, you know?
Indeed, that's a challenge. But let's bring it back to the book, though, because we want to focus. Yeah. I mean, I think that secondary gain is a fascinating topic, but let's bring it a little bit back to some of the stories in the book. And because I think that's what our listeners want to hear is primarily about the TMS aspects of it. Because believe me, I'm sure we could go on for hours about the political aspects. But does anyone have any thoughts about the about that? I mean, I think that in Pathways to Pain Relief, they talked a little bit about how this can meet some psychological needs as well. Like you can, if you need to have caretaking, you can be taken care of if you have a wound, if you're sick. It reminds me a little bit of Gabor Mate's book, When the Body Says No, where a lot of the people that he profiles are people who are, you know, they're such TMSers. They're always helping other people. They're always taking care of, you know, friends or parents or whoever else. And then eventually the body just has to say no. And in some sense, maybe that's a little bit like unconscious secondary gain. You know, it's like the body is rebelling.
It wants a timeout. It's the goodest. And the example in the book, Sarno's book, about the soldiers who were injured severely and were taken off the battlefield, this doctor found out that they needed very little morphine because they were so grateful for being taken away from the tension of war and to be in a safe place in a hospital somewhere that they didn't need much morphine for their severe injuries.
Indeed.
That's where just being alive is enough. That's like after you've gone through a very harrowing experience, you will feel very serotonined out for a number of days.
Well, they're off the battlefield of life. They get a timeout. It's a vacation. They no longer have to help everyone or be good or anything. They get to lie there, and the nurse comes in, and everything is taken care of them. Taken care of, and maybe they earned it, you know? I've been in the hospital a couple of times briefly myself, and people complain about hospitals, but tell you the truth, I didn't mind it at all for 3 days at a time. I thought it was restful, but I also like having my teeth clean, so I think I'm in a minority.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I bet you enjoyed the nurses too, didn't you, Tom?
Yeah.
I was totally biting my tongue. I wanted to leap on that you enjoy having your teeth cleaned thing, but I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, no, I think it's, you sit in this nice chair, it's relaxing. You know, it's the same thing as acupuncture, except you get some real benefit, your teeth get clean. But it's a timeout. You know, you're not working, you're not on the battlefield of life. You get a timeout briefly for 45 minutes. It's a comfortable chair. I feel relaxed. I even had a good root canal recently. If they give you enough painkiller, you know, you just watch the TV up there, and you got a good root canal specialist, and they're not that bad. You know, so that's just me.
I don't like root canals. I don't care how much medicine they give me.
I think one of the main things, guys, that keeps people from getting better, other than some of the things that we've already talked about, is just something they're missing, something that's right underneath their nose, and they're still doing it. It's something about a trait, something about the personality trait, and they're still doing it. I just believe with all my heart from all the posts I've answered and all the people I've talked to that it's just something there that they're still doing it. It's I don't know. It's just something that, well, I do know. It's just something that's, how do you say it? It's part of the personality trait. They were born with it, and it's like they're still doing it, and it's causing tension somehow in the body. And when it causes the tension, the pain still lingers. And, you know, some people's 2 or 3 months into it, 4 or 5 months into it, and they're not getting the results that other people are getting, and they're wondering what's going on. Well, they still might have, you know, judgmental thoughts towards certain people in their life. They still might be having bad relationships that they might need to resolve. The list could go on and on for pages and pages and pages. They're all written in the book here. The thing is, make a checklist. I would say make a checklist with Steve's book here and check them all off. Or like Tennis Tom says, do the Roy Holmes test and check it all off and see what's going on and make peace with it. Let it go and go on and live your, and, you know, have a happy life.
I wonder, you know, about the underlying motivations, though, for embracing secondary game as a strategy to keep the pain going. I think about that example that Steve gives of the movie Singing Detective with the psychiatrist and who is it, the disturbed writer, where Steve says how trauma from childhood can lurk and grow into generalized anger at the world, and how disease is chosen and harvested when the time is right, although not always at logical times. So the motivation for this secondary gain could be that what Dr. Sarno talks about, the underlying rage. I'm a victim, I'm passive suffering, but what is it that's making them grab at this? There's probably something deep and dark inside that's making it. That's where the Jungian shadow work comes in, confronting those things that are motivating these strategies that are obviously self-defeating. You know, I mean, living at the end of the dirt road in Oregon with no phone connection.
Was that bad or good? Bruce, that sounded good to me. She's getting a government check and she gets to live out in the forest in Oregon. That to me sounded like a win-win-win. Is that a bad thing?
She's not having a life. She's not interacting happily with her brother and her family. She's going into this isolation ward living.
A lot of people are still mad because they have the pain. You know, they get angry at the pain, you know, and they don't understand, you know, a year later, why is it still there? You know, I mean, come on, you know, and then they get angry at it and they forget to meditate that day or to forget to soothe that day or to forget to try to keep their mind off from it like they're supposed to. I think it all goes back to the basics, you know, the 12 daily reminders and the other 100 things that we're here to do. It's got to be one of those missing links.
Well, Kirby, they need their pain. The purpose of their pain is to keep them from facing those serious emotional things that they're fearful of facing, like, hey, let's get a divorce. I can't stand this. That'd be one. That's the main one. Steve emphasizes the main cause of TMS is relationships, bad ones. And they're afraid after being in this marriage for forever of saying the words, you know, I want out. And they're not going to get out, and they're going to go down with their TMS. And that's an awful great reason to have pain, is not to have to face that saying those words to somebody, you know?
Yeah, but then there's conditioned behavior too, isn't there? Just beyond marriage, just they don't want to leave their rut that they've been conditioned to. It's easier to go into the grocery store and buy broccoli in a certain preordained pattern that they always follow.
Well, they're homeostasis.
Overturn the apple cart, so to speak, to mix metaphors, and get and go to some other shop, go to Whole Earth instead of Safeway or whatever. That's too much of a change. You just wonder how conditioned we all are, though. Even the
very
buying habits and everything, like
what about
95% is conditioning. According to Steve, 95% of our conditioning is in the back primitive brain. That's where all of our life's inputs have gone. 95% of it. Only 5% of it is in the amygdala or frontal cortex, the conscious, mindful, in the now brain. That's only 5%. And we don't understand that brain chemistry, that what drives us is unknown to us and is in the 95% primitive brain, our seat of the pants, old wives' tales, memes. That is our what drives us through life, and only 5% of it is really thoughtful decision-making brain.
That's exactly why this libertarian author is attacking Sam Harris and the neuroscientists in the pages of The Atlantic this morning, taking them to task for that. But I think the role of the unconscious, if you go back to Freud, it's been for 100 years that we've realized that it's that 95% of our brain that is really making decisions for us that we aren't entirely aware of. I mean, psychology, by its very nature, goes against that, you know, free will deterministic. It goes against free will in that simplistic sense. You know, you can choose your life. You can go and work at this company and make a lot of money, and then everything will be okay because you make a lot of money, and this is what you're supposed to do because you shouldn't think or have any kind of the ahistorical approach to everything. You know, it all begins now, this morning. Make it new, brave new world.
Well, yeah, you can. Steve Book says you can do it. That's what he preaches, is change your life. You know, but it's difficult. He had to have his wife hit him with a baseball bat to change his to make his breakthrough. Not too many people are willing to do that or think that'll do it. Steve's book has given me hope that, yeah, it's going to be a tough road, man. I don't have it as tough as him. My wife didn't get paralyzed in childbirth. I have nowhere near his problems, so mine should be easier. But it's not easy to break it, especially when you're facing the medical industrial establishment who says a pill will do it or an operation will do it. Mm-hmm. And no, you're going to have to do it. You're going to have to take that first step and keep taking those steps. And that's what he preaches. Steve-O preaches, just do it. You can control your life. And it takes one step, that first step, as Zen says. You know, it all starts with one step.
Well, I think it's like Lipton, too. The change has to begin within your limbic system. You have to change the biochemistry or the neurobiology of your brain. Those are real choices, not buying apples or oranges or getting into the right company and making a lot of money.
You're changing really the way that you feel about the world, the way that you interact
yes.
with the world, because this knowledge therapy changes things. Now you no longer need to be afraid of the pain, and you also know to think psychologically. And so you really experience things deeply. You feel your emotions, and you connect with them, and then you release them, and you know that you don't have to hide them.
Yeah, well, Steve says someplace in here, I don't know if it's 36 or 37, it involves a complete makeover. When somebody starts TMS therapy, if they're going to succeed, they're going to be a new person at the end of it. And we try and evade it different ways. We try and go back to our old habits. But if we're going to get there, we've got to become new people, new brains, you know, new brains for old.
Yeah, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine, you know, and that's the whole deal. You got the pain, you know, you got all the repressions, it's causing the pain, and it's wanting you to become, you know, who you've always wanted to be. And wow, you know, it takes a lot of work to figure out, you know, how to get there.
Remember where Steve says that his brain lit up so much that it raised his electric power bill?
Yeah,
that's the kind of thing that goes on when you start going through these power therapies. I certainly have with these programmed dreams. And it takes a lot of energy, doesn't it? I notice I'm tired afterwards. It's like you're running your brain on overtime doing that kind of stuff. A different kind of fatigue than physical fatigue. It's kind of like you're loose and mellow, but something's happened.
Yeah. Okay, so you're going to have to tell us a little bit about how the programming dreams are coming. Like, okay, we've been following along for 2 weeks now.
Mm-hmm. No, after that big one where I was driving my family in the white limousine that was like a hearse to the dinner where I was going to meet the girl that I was supposed to marry, and I was dealing with, in the unconscious, with them as dead and not having any feelings, it all stopped. I felt mellow for a couple of days. And then last night, I had a dream where I was in the exchequer of a bank with a bunch of different players around a circle, like we were playing blackjack or something. but I watched a show on the development of banking in England the night before, and then they all said they were worried about doing their taxes, and I said, I just did my taxes. So there we just have two things in my personal life, doing the taxes and watching the show on banking, coming together in the dream. And maybe there was an unconscious space there about anxiety and stuff, but it didn't have nearly the dramatic power of the ones up to that big one.
So you're not getting the big.
It seems like once you've had the big one, one that's really been powerful, you're not good for it. You've dissipated that unconscious energy that was repressed. It's come to the surface, and then you feel really mellow for a while, and then it takes a while to get recharged again. Maybe it's like once you do it once right, you did it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my conclusion about it.
Okay, you're still trying it before you go to bed.
But for about a week after I had the big one, they weren't there.
Weren't that exciting?
Bubbling up. Once it's reached that point where you get a plot that works its way through in your unconscious, and you get all these perceptions, you have. What is that reintegration, or what is that consolidation?
Reconsolidation, right.
It takes a while to reconsolidate all of that unconscious data that you've released and learn from it.
So I bet I'm not the only person who's curious about this. And like I said, we've kind of been following along with this for 2 weeks. Is there like a three-step process that you could tell us? About how this works. Like, if you want to do the program Dreams, what do you do before you go to bed? I'm just curious.
Well, what I've been doing is to read some of Dr. Alexander's chapter on program Dreams, read a short section of it before I go to bed. Then I do progressive breathing, Buddhist breathing, like 4-7-8, 4-7-8. And I try and clear my mind, and then I do relaxation while doing the breathing, progressive relaxation through the different steps. Start with your neck, with your face. Mm-hmm. With your
so you do a bunch
shoulders.
Of relaxation and meditation.
Yeah,
things.
A bunch of relaxation just before you go to sleep. And what I've found is the most powerful where I've had the dreams is where if I wake up at 3 a.m. and do that progressive relaxation and then go to sleep, because then when I wake up, I'll be waking up from REM and I will retain a memory of it.
Gotcha.
Whereas if I do it right at bedtime at, midnight or 11 p.m.
So it's basically just reading from Dr. Alexander and then doing some meditation before bed.
Yeah, exactly. But the breathing to relax and get into space where you're relaxed and you don't have any. And I noticed, too, that the night I did have a big eruption, had that strange symbolic dream, I had ridden my bicycle that day and gotten really tired out. So I wasn't burdened with a bunch of distracting mental gossip. I really wanted to get to sleep. I wanted to get into a deep. Whereas if you've had an argument that day, or you're concerned about something, you have to be relaxed first, and that get through all of that negative mental chatter, get it out of your head. That's what I'd say first. Whatever it is get rid of the mental gossip, and that'll
get rid of the mental
unconscious come out. That's my thoughts on it.
Oh, fascinating. So North Star, who's been following along, just pasted into the Fuse chat room in babiesneedmothers.com. And this is Dr. What's his name again?
McClancy,
yes.
Yep, there we go.
Babiesneedmothers.com, the instructions, how to program your dreams.
Oh, I read
some
of
you just
that
type
too.
That into Google, the page will come up.
I've been spoiling it because I've been reading widely in the dream therapy stuff. Sampling. Sample around in there. See what works for you.
Well, this guy's got like a little recipe of a specific script that you say. Tonight I will dream about, should I buy that new car? And I will awake and remember the dream and I will write it down. Or if it's something that's potentially painful, tonight I will dream about, the child that beat me up when I was a kid. It will not be frightening. So he's got a script that you follow. And then he also recommends, I just bought some vitamin B6.
Wow.
Just the other day, because he says, take 100 milligrams of vitamin B6. And he said, if you really want to rev things up, take 200 milligrams, but no, you might have difficulty sleeping if you do that. So I haven't quite, sleep is still too precious to me that I'm nervous about taking something that could disrupt my sleep. So I haven't tried. I did take it though, because I usually lay down in the afternoon for about 20 minutes. And I took one about 20 minutes before then. And I can't say I reported any different, noticed any differences on it, but it's interesting. One of these nights I'll give it a try at bedtime and I'll let you know about it.
Scripting your dreams like that, like Mackenzie, but he also talks about re-scripting them. If you're in a nightmare situation where you're powerless and you're waking up from when you confront something that's really traumatic, before you go to bed, think about taking control in there. Re-scripting the dream so it has a different outcome that's positive.
Yeah, I think that actually, it's foggy in my head right now, but a couple weeks ago I did have something that happened in one of my dreams where I had the typical anxiety dream, only the last time I had the dream it resolved peacefully. Mm-hmm. And I woke up, I went, wow, that was pretty cool. But I can't even remember it right now. I sat down and journaled it.
You did journal it. So, yeah, I found that last week explaining it to the group had a tremendous beneficial effect, because the next morning after this session, I woke up with no TMS whatsoever. So it's working. There's something to it.
Yeah, last night I had out. Well, I was going to say, last night I had a strange dream, and it was kind of one of those chicken or the egg dreams. The shin pain that I've had for years has been surfacing its head again. And last night in my dream, I had some kind of conflict going on. And in my dream, my leg started hurting. And I thought, aha, there you have it. And I actually woke up and my stupid leg was hurting. So it's like, oh, well, isn't that interesting? Now, some people would say, well, your leg was hurting and therefore you woke up. But I think with what I'm learning, it's like, no, I was able to see the connection between the conflict of what was going on and then the manifestation of the pain in my leg.
Steve says in here that cramps are TMS.
Mm-hmm.
And remember what the directions he gives in here? Instead of concept of thinking about the cramps as being something painful and tensing, rephrase them, re-script them. Think about them as operating a different way.
Just let it be. Don't tense. Don't try to fight it. Just let it be. I know what you're talking about.
He says that somewhere in there.
Yeah, he did rephrase the way he was talking about these cramps. I used to have them all the time. I had them for like 20 years. I always attributed it to being out in the hot heat, working on the hot roofs, and losing so much water. But, 5-6 months after having breaks and being in cool weather and all of that, I would still have them. And a lot of times I remember if I had 2 or 3 weeks off, from working in construction or something, I would still be having these cramps. And eventually, it was like I could think in my mind, oh gosh, because I'd feel this little cramp coming on, and then I'd have this fear pop in my mind that it's going to get real bad. And then all of a sudden, I'd have this big, huge knot in my leg. So I knew it was TMS after a while. And they went away, and I ain't had them since. I ain't had them in over 2 years, so...
So how did you, I could use some help with this, because like one of my big issues, which is interesting, because the worst of my leg pain started when I was pregnant 20 years ago. I mean, it was the leg cramp from hell, and that has been my most consistently distracting symptom. It abated for a while, and now I feel like I'm I'm backsliding in that it's bothering me again. My Achilles gets swollen. They get very tight. And it's like, God, this is just, I'm open for any suggestions. I mean, I'm doing everything that I know to do with meditation and visualization and speaking to my brain and doing this. But, you know, when I get up out of a chair and I've got a knot in the back of my Achilles again, which, by the way, this has been treated, and I'm confident it's TMS because I've seen everybody about it. It went from like my one ankle over to my other one. And it's like, man, how do I get a handhold on this?
Started,
I feel like I'm going.
The way I started out North Star is I would actually consciously tell it to stop. I mean, just the old Sarno method, you know, stop. And it didn't work for the first month or two of saying that to it. And when these cramps would come on in my legs, it would be so bad that I thought I was going to die one time from it, because it would last 3 or 4 hours and it would just knot more and more and more and more knots.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was going to just throw up a lot of times. It got so bad, the pain did. But I would just I'd tell it to stop mentally, not out loud. Mentally, I would tell it to stop. And after a while, about a month, just 1 second. After about 1 month, it started stopping. When I would say stop, it would just release, and it would let up. And 2 years later, I don't have them at all.
Well, that's good to hear. I felt like I'd gained some progress in it, but it's like, you know, that same old thing where TMS is just knocking, seeing which door handle it can jiggle and find it. And I think that's my Achilles, really, right in my Achilles. It's a very upsetting symptom to me. And I've been doing that. I guess it's just back to the persistence thing of telling them, knock it off, brain.
Well, I had a lot of fear because it had already made me so sick and so scared of it that, oh my gosh, here comes another cramp. What's it going to do? Am I going to make it? Are they going to rush me to the hospital? Because usually when it would hit one leg, it would hit me in the hamstring and then the calf, and then it would hit my other leg. And I would have like 3 or 4 of them going at one time. So,
oh yeah.
When that would happen, I would have to stand for 3 or 4 hours in the middle of the night. And when it finally would let up, I would just be exhausted. But I just started realizing it was TMS. And like I said, I started when it first started to start, I'd tell it to stop. So,
Herbie, how do you think this relates to chapter 37? Is it gone yet? Where he uses that, God. Steve uses that quote from Plato, attention to life is life's greatest, attention to health is life's greatest hindrance. And he comes up with a watch plot never boils, a watch body never heals. But Steve advises that when you're continuing to feel pain, such obsessive system checks must stop. And it sounds like these cramps that people are getting is like TMS knocking, tapping them on the shoulder and perpetuating this obsessive brain disorder where you're preoccupied so much with symptoms. It's like when it's really bad, of course, you're laid up. But as it slowly goes away, as the oxygen debt decreases, then you'll get these surges again. It's like it's tapping you on the shoulder, trying to get your brain again. It's trying to grab your brain. It's trying to make you, it's trying to say, hey, I'm still here. Pay attention to me. And Steve says that's what perpetuates the symptom in chapter 37. He says that this constant monitoring. Yeah. I remember when I used to get up in the morning, I'd have no pain. And then as consciousness came on, as I woke up, then the first thought on my mind was, is it still there? Then I get out of bed, and if I put on my pant leg and I'd hear a pop, that would be a signal for the thing to take off and rise through the day for the pain to go on.
Oh, yeah. I'm
programmed that way. And now I hear a pop and it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Steve unequivocally says cramps are TMS.
Yes,
and
he does.
Once I read that and coincidentally had a cramp, I said, that's TMS. I've had cramps all my life. When you're young, they're called growing pains. When you wake up, and the first time I had one when I was a kid, I thought, how could I have broken my leg sleeping in bed? It was so bad. It was my first one ever. I was 9 years old or whatever. I said, I broke my leg. And then I realized, now that's a cramp. But it was terribly painful, like a broken leg. So Steve says, it's TMS. And once I read that, I said, now if I get a cramp, it's TMS. And it goes away almost, it melts away. Before
right.
I thought, yeah, before, you know, I've done a lot of running, marathons, a lot of tennis. I've gotten cramps a lot. And I always said, well, it's that lactic acid buildup. And my lady friend gets cramps and she has to jump out of bed and stuff. But now that I view it as TMS, I just recently can make it melt away, and I don't give it any thought anymore.
There you go. That's the answer.
Wow.
That's it. That's it, North Star.
Well, wow. All I noticed is when I used to live in the mountains and I ran passes at altitude, I would come back and go to sleep in my car in the back seat, and I'd have absolutely no cramps whatsoever. I was in a total slug, mentally unstressed state. And
yeah.
I'd wake up when I'd wake up, and I'd go to bed when I went to bed. But, however, after TMS in 2001, after my mother died, if I'd ride my bike, I'd come back and get in bed, cramps. It's mm-hmm. like that's its way of knocking on your door.
Yeah.
I had cramps too, North Star, and I would say absolutely TMS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I still get them sometimes, but, you know, it's just not nearly as serious because I know that they're not serious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Steve seems to say that you have to stop paying attention to this and just go live. It's this constant tendency to monitor. I certainly notice it in myself. It's pulling away. It's distant from me now. But I still see myself doing it at some deep level.
You see, I'd lay down, and I'd have in my mind, oh, God, you know, because it always hit me at night when I lay down. And I have in my mind, oh, God, not. I hope it doesn't happen tonight. And that's when it would happen. As soon as I had that thought, even if I didn't, I would say it just in my mind. And as soon as I had that thought, lo and behold, here it come, just, you know, it'd start knotting up a little bit. And then I'd be like, oh, gosh, and I'd get up, try to straighten my legs out, try to get myself, you know, stretched out or whatever. And it would just, next thing I know, 3 or 4 hours of hell. And thank God I found
like
out it was TMS.
These cramps occur in what anthropologist Victor Turner called liminal space. And Steve says is the space where the first door has been opened, but the second has not yet been entered. And that's where he's talking about this complete transformation that a TMS healing requires. As long as you're getting those cramps, you're still in an era of transition. You're in that liminal space.
Well, and it's so funny because I can totally, it's like the conditioned behavior, which I'm cognizant of it and I've got to stop it. I'll feel the tightness in my Achilles and I'll instinctively, conditioned wise, I'll bend over to feel, okay, how's my Achilles? Is the lump there? And it will go up and down throughout the day. And it's like, knock it off. It's fine. So I'm listening to everything you fellas are saying. And you too, North Star. I really appreciate the encouragement. And it's good to hear that you overcame this despite the chronicity of it. Because this has been years in the making for me. I mean, years. Well, since my boy, he's almost 20. So I've had 20 years of dealing with leg issues.
Wow.
Yeah, sounds like Tennis Thomas had it all his life, basically, from the time he was 9.
You know, I had those cramps, too, when I was little. I remember crawling into bed with my mom when I was, you know, probably 6 years old, just crying, you know, back in the 60s, and all they had was aspirin. what we know now, though, it's TMS.
Well, then they were called growing pains. They were called growing pains. But actually, it was, I believe now in retrospect, it was the tension of maybe changing schools the tension of going, cultural tension of, you know, growing up is not that, you know, that great of a thing lots of times. If you're a TMS personality, a lot of times I'd get out of school by faking, you know, colds, and I was, you know, I could do it pretty well. I was faking it. My mother would finally just give up and say, okay, I'll give him the day off today. But a lot of people get cramps, yeah. And I think it's pretty normal. But if it is TMS, it's benign, it's painful. That's the definition of TMS. It's benign, painful as hell, but not serious, and it's not structural, it's not injury. So I got just one little interesting anecdote. I will get a cramp. My hands will around the steering wheel in the same spot, Santa Cruz, California. Every time I go through there on Highway 1, both my hands will become lobster hands around the steering wheel, almost to the same exact spot in the road. And then I started putting it together. Yeah, this is emotional TMS, but it's weird. But TMS is weird because 95% of our freaking brains is weird and not under our conscious control. It's only that 5% that we control. And once you accept that fact, you just laugh it off and say, life is funny.
You notice how Kareem, in his success story, is that his name, Kareem, in the success story, is such a calm, placid, mellow individual. But that can mean that in his unconscious, there is a regular raging bull. It seems like the person who's adopted these calm, outward mannerisms, i.e. repressed, often has another life inside that's going on that's much more primitive and powerful.
Good point.
Yeah, it's like, what do they call it? That's like the man and the masks. There's the mask and that you present to the world, and then there's the anti-self, the Nietzschean anti-self, the monster inside, you know, who wants to get out. So every
that's
time you
true,
drive along...
I don't know. I don't get that big of a vibe from North Star, though.
there's different kinds of repression.
North Star.
Thank you, Forrest.
Where's the enemy within North Star? Where's that beast?
I like this on page 328. You know, in the chapter we're on now, is it gone yet? He says here, all beings perform more efficiently when not overloaded and pressured, you know? And the self-pressures we put on ourselves every day, you know, to get better or to meditate right, or am I balancing myself right, or, you know, is the race soothe ratio right? You know, am I programming the dreams right? You know, just do the best you can do, and then be glad with that and be happy of it and go about your day, you know? Because we can put pressure on ourselves, you know, trying to meditate right, you know? I had somebody the other day tell me he couldn't meditate, you know? He couldn't relax. And, wow, you know, that's a lot of pressure on yourself if you can't relax. So, you know, he, and I believe in my heart he can't relax is because, you know, he's still tensed up. He hasn't learned how to do, well, I know him hard. He hasn't learned how to relax.
You have the best advice, Herbie. I love that.
Yes,
yeah.
You do.
And Bob said,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Can I sneak in, Bruce?
Yeah, go ahead.
Don't sneak in. You're going on good.
Thank you. Well, A, Herbie, you have the best advice. And B, this was actually coming up in the chat room, the other chat room. There was a gentleman there named Casey Field, and you know, one of the big ideas that comes up is that there just is mysteries in TMS healing. I mean, I think we know an awful lot about the brain, but what we don't know about the brain, I think, is so much larger than what we do. And I think there's just mysteries. I wish I knew why these things happen the way that they do, but that's the way it seems to go. And then I just go back to Tennis Tom's excellent advice of just, you know, just facing that mystery and embracing it. That's all I got. Yeah,
that's really good, Forrest. That's, you know, good, Brene man. Brown said something about how religion and science, how they are at odds together. And she said something to the oh, I wish I could remember the gist of it better, but it was something about how they're not exclusive. There's a, a meeting in the middle, if you will, involving mystery. And I love that. You know, it's especially how the faith community has taken faith and has turned it into certainty. And then you get this red face, you know, and there's a lot of anger behind it. So I really, I'll have to find that and then post it on Facebook, because it was just such a great meme, what she said about they're not exclusive. It's the mystery that brings them together. And
Jung called it the Mysterium Conjunctionis. It's that liminal space, isn't it? It's
Mysterious cojones? What?
No, Mysterium Conjunctionis.
What does that mean, Bruce?
Salute.
It's the point where the conscious and the unconscious mind meet.
Where sorry. Yeah. Never mind.
But Lop Sang
in the cojones.
Lop Sang Trungpa.
We love you, Bruce.
Cutting through spiritual materialism. And he talks about how people get seduced by the outward trappings of spirituality, like doing so many spiritual exercises, so many yoga poses. And it seems like we get trapped in that with TMS healing by trying to do things right and trying to have experiences and stuff like that. It's like you have to just let it be.
Yeah, like one person to say, why can't I be like this other guy? Why can't I heal like they did, you know?
Yeah.
They healed in 3 weeks. What's wrong with me, you know?
Trungpa says that's spiritual pride.
Yeah.
It makes its ego stands in
Bruce,
the way.
You might know this. You're from Berkeley, right? I was trying to look up Google recently. I remember while back my yoga teacher said that the head of the Berkeley Zen or Meditation Center, I think it was a lady, got back problems and could no longer sit and meditate in the, you know, the lotus position on the cushion. And it was interesting because the purpose of the yoga poses, the asanas, is to prepare one to meditate, to do the other 8 limbs or 10, whichever you're from, of yoga. And the asanas prepare the body so the mind can sit there and meditate. So I just I couldn't find it. Have you ever heard that? It was years ago, but
Trungpa was in Boulder. He ran the Naropa Institute, and he's the living representative of the Karyupta dynasty from Tibet, from Marpa, going back about 1,300 years. And he talks about the problems that occur when people try and do things too spiritually correctly, or trying to do healing the right way and trying to get the right results, and how much that's connected with our own pride, with what keeps us rooted in not healing, not being enlightened.
Being perfectionist, the T personality.
We're perfectionists, so we try and do TMS healing perfectly and put all this pressure on ourselves. And Steve just says, go live. Doesn't he?
Just do it. Yep. Yeah. He says, enjoy life. Have a good time. Drink a bottle of wine. You know, go out on a date or whatever.
Good advice.
A lot of people that wants to do things in their life and really enjoy life, they hold themselves back. They feel like, you know, they're not worthy or whatever the case might be, and they hold themselves back. And a lot of times, you know, the tension inside the subconscious will create pain in the body because they're not doing what they really want to do. You know, basically enjoying life, you know, like you said, Tennis Tom and Bruce. And everybody here said that. There was one thing that I was reading in the book here, and it was a guy. It was about a guy that, or it might have been a woman or whatever, that thought they deserved the pain because of I think it's something spiritual. Let me read it here. I did want to bring this up. He says, finally, I have also met some people who have refused to relinquish their pain because they believe it is a justified punishment for something they have done. And this is on page 323, Bruce, David Bressler. And I did go back to the other chapter. But some people think that the pain they have is for some punishment. And I met a man like that one time, and he had lost both legs. And he told me he wouldn't change it for anything because that was what God gave him for all the things he had done wrong in his life. God took his legs from him. And it broke my heart to hear it. But it wasn't long after that, and he went home to be with the Lord. But I can't wrap my head around that, you know, when somebody thinks that, you know, this happened to me and I deserved it, you know.
It sounds like this connects with what George Grodek says about Das Is, the it force that controls all diseases. Steve says that what's currently popular in suffering is what people will catch or use at an unconscious level for self-punishment against darker pleasure. And I know that Grodek was associated with Freud, and I suppose that has to do with the pleasure principle and the will to death, eros, thanatos, and so on. But he says that unconscious level for self-punishment against darker pleasure. It's like they can't enjoy things, so they hurt themselves and hold on to these pain models, these victimized roles. Mm-hmm. It's like there's some prohibition going on there, some resistance.
Steve had the example of the young kid, I think, whose father took him aside and said, look, your mom and I are getting a divorce because it's all your fault. And these kids 8 years old, and throughout the rest of his life, he carried that with him. And he was punishing himself because he felt he was the reason for his parents' divorce.
Wow.
And he wasn't, you know, but his father said, told him that. What an asshole. I mean, pardon me.
Yeah, well, he was. I believe he was just that, brother.
Well, kids tend to take that on anyway, don't they? I think Steve says that before he says that, but this was quite literal. But sometimes parents do that, don't they? They say, you're part of this, you're part of our conflict, so you better play ball with this, you know, play ball with this system.
They're arguing.
Your ball. That's why we're fighting.
They're in a big argument one day, and you come in the door, you're 5 years old, and you hear them screaming and yelling, you're already scared, and they turn around and say this, or one of them does, and says, this is all your fault. And it might be because he was in the road or something, you know. But that little child doesn't, you know, they take it in fear, and then it sticks in their body. It's something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what Steve says is the resistance, isn't it? That's the fundamental resistance is this rage from childhood, from incidents like that make people cling to those victimization roles or their martyr roles or Harry Hemroid, Migraine Mary. They think they deserve it somehow.
Yeah. You know, that's you mentioned Migraine Mary. One of my symptom imperatives was having migraines. And I'm proud to say, you know, I think it's been like 3 or 4 months now, and I haven't had one to where I was having them like, wow, like 3 times a week. So that's just another symptom imperative that I've beat, you know, for 3 or 4 months now. I'm not saying it's totally gone, but at the same time, I stopped fearing them. And I've pretty much been doing real good. So, you know, trouble healers. You know, I fell in that category when it came to the migraines. So, and now I'm sitting here and telling you I've beat it. It took what, 18 months? But I beat that imperative. So
yay.
Right.
Yeah, so never give up, right, Tom? Never give up, right, North Star? I mean, just
That's right. Have a glass of wine.
Have a glass of wine, that's it. Keep going and you know
celebrate.
Yeah, because we all, in a way, you know, have an imperative somewhere that's still lingering on. And some people give themselves such a hard time because they haven't healed all the way yet. Well, guess what? You know, we're organic, we're human beings, and we're always going to have a little pain somewhere. So just hold your head up and know that if you have healed in certain areas and you have made progress, you're doing good. Progress equals progress, you know? That's what it's all about. And is it gone yet? Well, that's the question you ask to keep it there. You know, the more you ask, are we there yet, the longer the ride takes, right?
I see where North Star has posted something from Facebook by Brené Brown, and it seems to emphasize this necessity of mystery, you know, keeping the mysteries open, the space where things can change. Intuition is not a single way of knowing. It's our ability to hold space for uncertainty and our willingness to trust the many ways we develop knowledge and insight, including instinct, experience, faith, and reason. I think that's a great quote.
Awesome. Well, anything Brené Brown puts out, I just absolutely love. She is brilliant.
Yes, she is. Well, guys,
hey, guys, my computer is about ready to, my battery's just about dead, so I'm going to say goodnight. You guys are the best.
You're the best, too.
Take care.
Y'all have
Thanks
a great evening.
You
God
too.
Bless you.
Okay,
yeah,
good night.
Good to have you there.
Thanks, everybody. We're going to end it on that note. Is that okay, Forrest?
You Sounds okay good to me. I love it short and quick.
All right, good deal.
Covered a lot of territory here.
Thanks, guys. That's it.